On this week's Bet the Process podcast, we have some soccer talk, a football talk with Sarah Rudd, who is the brains behind Arsenal's analytics group. For 10 years she did that, and now she started her own sports consultancy in the world of soccer, I mean football. So with that, let's start the process.
Bet the process. Bet the process. Welcome to the podcast. Bet the process. It's not that typical cookie cutter nonsense. If you came just for picks, you're in the wrong place. Find a tout with the narrative to make a strong case. Instead of blindly assuming a team must be tanking, we're looking for the edge of massive Peabody rankings. Crunching all the numbers in a simulated system that break down the data, analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic. The bottom line.
Welcome to another episode of the Bet the Process podcast, where Rufus has a really, really thick mustache, for those of you guys wondering.
Thanks.
No, I just wanted to paint a little picture of things. How was your mustache? Is it everything you thought it would be?
And more.
This is a busy season for you, right? You got lots of mustache golf, season. You got lots of basketball, you got lots of mustache. How are you managing all that?
You know, you're right, it's very busy. Not managing well enough, clearly. You know what's funny, Jeff, is I had a, and then this past week, like, I had a bed bug scare. I thought that I had some bites on my ankles that looked like, in like arms that I got like the night after I came back from Sloan. Like, I woke up in my bed scratching, and I finally went and got pest control people to come in to look. I'd done all these thorough inspections. I had washed all my sheets, all my clothes on hot, put them in garbage bags. I was like, I'd heard all these horror stories, but turns out I don't have bed bugs. I have no idea why I had bites of some sort, but it was a little bit stressful. So that made it, the week extra challenging. Plus Jeff, we, unfortunately our golf winning streak came to an end. We had won the first 9 weeks of 2024 and we lost last week.
Bummer.
So maybe I should shave the mustache.
Maybe it's the time.
I don't know. College basketball's been doing well though. So it's kind of like, as long as we keep having stringing together winning weeks, the mustache stays.
Okay. Well, we're going to welcome in Sarah Rudd, who is a friend of ours that we've gotten to know at the Sloan Conference. And she's become a regular at our fun dinners. Very big fans of the work she's doing in soccer. She's sort of the woman behind the scenes for Arsenal's rise over the last 10 years. She's not there anymore, but she ran Arsenal's analytics group for quite some time. So if you guys are into that football stuff, the across the pond football stuff, this will be a treat for you. And we'll talk to you guys all on the other side. We now welcome in Sarah Rudd to the Bet the Process podcast. Sarah, you are rare for us. You are a woman and you are in soccer. So we will start one by introducing. Why don't you tell us a little bit about all that you've accomplished and what brought you into the soccer world? Obviously, I came across you when I was part of a soccer team ownership. And I asked my friend Eben, I said, hey, we need to get some smart soccer people at this dinner we're putting together. And he was like, oh, you need to get Sarah Rudd. She is like brilliant. And he kept talking about how amazingly smart you were and how you were such a great piece of the building of Arsenal. So tell us a little about your background and how you got into soccer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm probably most known for two things. One, I wrote one of the earliest papers on like a value model in soccer. So trying to value like how much each action contributes to the likelihood of your team scoring a goal. And then also I ran the analytics department at Arsenal for about 10 years. So that was, yeah, like a pretty cool experience for me. But, you know, in terms of why soccer and how I got into that, I mean, it's a sport that I always loved. But, you know, at the time that I was going to school and kind of starting my career, like sports analytics wasn't really a thing. So it wasn't really ever something that like I dreamed about. But I always was kind of like looking for ways that, you know, maybe I could work in the sports industry, but specifically soccer for a while. So I thought about doing, you know, a football, I'll call it football, I apologize. But when I say football, I mean soccer, but like a football specific.
That proves that you're legit. Like people say soccer aren't legit at all.
My dad is English, and technically I'm a British citizen, so like I do have that I guess like street cred going for me as well. But yeah, I thought about doing like a football specific MBA over in the UK, and then kind of chickened out. Like I wasn't ready to go like that far down the line, so ended up moving to South America. That just made like this whole like I call it a sickness, but like yeah, like obsession with the sport like even worse. So down there, it's like, okay, I got to figure something out. Ended up moving to Seattle, where I worked for Microsoft for a number of years. So like my undergraduate degrees were in computer science and environmental science. So that wasn't like a too far off the beaten path for me. But while I was there, I just started thinking about like the MBA again and how I could use that to maybe get my foot in the door. So I decided to do a program at University of Washington, thinking that maybe it was like Nike and Adidas there, like maybe I could work in like one of their football business units and then maybe use that to transition over to a club. In doing so, I ended up talking to a guy named Adrian Hanauer. He's the owner of the Seattle Sounders. And he was the first person to say to me like, hey, have you read Moneyball? Do you know who Shane Battier is? Like, could we actually do this in soccer? And so that was really cool because I'd never thought of it before. So he kind of planted the seed in my head. Ended up going to Sloan as like an MBA student, like talking to people and they're like, hey, if you really want to do this, like you got to show clubs what you can do. And so the following year, this company called StatDNA, they had a research competition where they just gave you like a really, really nice data set and said, do whatever you want with it and we'll pick a winner. And then the winner gets to present at a conference. So I thought that was really, really cool. And that's where that like value model came from. I gave it like this really ridiculous name. But if anyone listening is familiar with expected threat, like it's a very similar thing, just with like a different implementation and a much worse name. And yeah, that caught the eye of the CEO of StatDNA. And he said, you know, why don't you come work for me? We really need somebody with kind of your background in software, but also data science and machine learning. And yeah, I thought it was like a really cool opportunity. I didn't know at the time that they were working with Arsenal. And so he told me that his exit strategy was basically to get acquired by Arsenal. I laughed in his face, and wouldn't you know it, within 12 months, we were acquired by Arsenal and became their in-house analytics department. So yeah, that's kind of how I got started, like really, really lucky.
So, I mean, the question is sort of like, was it harder to be a woman or an American in soccer analytics in the Premier League?
That's a really good question. And I'm going to go with American, but I guess I have to like explain why that is. So, you know, throughout my career, like, you know, whether it's working in sports, whether it's working in tech, like whenever you're kind of in like a minority or outsider group, like one of the ways that that manifests itself, or one of the ways that like difficulties manifest themselves, is like how much credibility or how much you're seen as an expert comes through. And so, you know, this was really common at a place like Microsoft, where you know, there's certain stereotypes that are just kind of seen as being more technical naturally. And when you're doing kind of like these performance reviews, one of the criteria is like, how much are you seen as being an expert? And so, you know, the system is kind of rigged in a little bit of a way that like, if you fit the stereotype of being more technical, then more of your coworkers are going to go to them for help. And so they kind of move up the ladder, whereas those who are kind of seen as outsiders don't move up as quickly. And so, you know, that's kind of what I was expecting to experience moving to sports and kind of being like a woman. And that actually wasn't the case at first, or it wasn't really the case at Arsenal at all. And so part of it was because, you know, I had a skill set. We were being brought in as this analytics company. So I had the skill set that nobody else at the club had. There were loads of people who were collecting data and wanted to do something with it, but really didn't have the skill set or the know-how really get started with it. And so because of my background in technology, I was seen as more of an expert in that area. And so like being a woman there didn't really hurt, because, you know, I had this unique skill set. Whereas I think when it came to like the football side, being American, they're kind of like, oh, what do you guys know about this type of football? Like, are you sure? And, you know, there are funny little like cultural issues around it where like, if you said game instead of match, they'd be like, ah, you're not using the right vocabulary, not using the right lingo. Therefore, like, you don't know what you're talking about. So just little things like that made it, I guess, like harder to be an American. But I think now, like working outside of the club, where there are a lot more people with like a similar skill set to mine out there, you know, you start to wonder like, oh, like, are they, you know, going to that person because they're seen as being more technical or credible just because they happen to look the part.
It sounds like a lot of it's just being able to speak that language. And I think we see it in American football too, where like these outsiders that come in, you know, the people that have been entrenched in this for a long time are sort of like, you don't speak our language. You don't know what you're talking about. It's like a community.
Yeah, I mean, there's almost like this inherent bias, and bias like exists in every profession there is. And like this idea that, I mean, because as the analytics people, we face a bias too, which is this idea of like, we never played the game, right? Like, and so how much of that did you see in soccer with you being an analytics person? And how did you win those people over, even though you didn't quote play the game, but obviously you did, you were passionate about soccer. Like that's, I didn't realize that you just like loved soccer and that's what got you into this. And like the classic, like analytics was your gateway to actually like have a skill that no one else did. But how do you win those people over that like don't take you serious? Not just because you didn't quote unquote play the game.
Yeah, it's really hard. And I think, you know, the approach that we tried to use when we were going into Arsenal, myself included, is like be really humble at first and be open and be listening. Like we didn't want to go in there like bulls in a china shop trying to say like you're wrong, like everything you've been doing for 100 years is completely off base. You know, I think with baseball, because of the way that that sport is structured, there's a lot of like inefficiencies that were just like able to evolve over time because of like it's very isolated interactions, whereas with soccer there's much more of like an adversarial nature to it. And so if somebody comes up with a more efficient way to play or like a new tactic that's gonna help them win, somebody's gonna come up with like a counter tactic to it. And so it's constantly evolving. And so like you don't necessarily have a lot that you can go in there and say like you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. So like, yeah, we would go in there, we try to observe what they're doing, understand, you know, how they're seeing the game. And then whenever we came up with something that we wanted them to start using, a lot of it was really around like sitting down with video and using video as the like common language and understanding like, well, what are you guys seeing here? What are we missing? Like, how can we kind of like put your brain down on paper or put your brain into code and kind of like come up with these models that represent what you're seeing? And so that was really nice because then they felt a little bit of like ownership over these models as well, because they were giving inputs into it. They understood how things were working a little bit better, like not from a technical standpoint, but like, this is what the model can capture. This is what it can't capture. Like it has no idea about hip orientation, for example, because we just don't have data on that. So there might be like a clip where they think it's like not as dangerous a situation because of the way that the defender is oriented his hips. And we'd say, well, we just can't see that. So, you know, the model is going to be limited. But yeah, I mean, video was really like the common language. And, you know, the really difficult thing with soccer in general is like it's such a global sport. So like, not only do you have to worry about American English versus British English, but then, you know, there's a change in coaching staff and now it's Spanish. And it's not just, you know, the type of Spanish that I had learned in South America, it's Spanish. And so now there's like a whole other part of vocabulary where like you can't use the South American word for goalkeeper. You have to use the Spain word for goalkeeper. So yeah, it's tricky for sure.
It's interesting. You talk about working with people that are basically domain experts, but don't have the technical skills. And I feel like that's always been a challenge for me, trying to get like, ask like questions of golfers. Jeff and I are big golf fans, and just like about grass type and stuff, and be like, look, I can answer these questions. If like, just give me the, it's like knowing what the right questions to ask are sometimes is, and if you can, like, being able to communicate and bring in people outside of that and sort of frame it in a way where they can actually help is, like, I feel like very difficult and something I haven't been able to do very well. And so I'm quite impressed.
Yeah, it's really hard. And, you know, like, one of the things I've learned as well, like, about language is that, like, each culture has different words for concepts, and, like, some cultures just don't have the right words yet. So I'm always jealous of basketball because, you know, there's God knows how many different types of pick and rolls, and there's, like, very, like, defined vocabulary for each one of those. And you can go to a coach and you can kind of say, like, what was that? And they can probably tell you exactly what that was. And if you went to a different coach, they probably have the same terminology for it. But yeah, because of the nature of the sport where it's very fluid, some of these ideas just don't translate literally, that, like, there's not necessarily good ways to talk about those ideas. And so then it's like, well, how do you get somebody to ask or answer a question when you don't even have the vocabulary to talk about it or to describe it? You know, when people are operating in their second or third language, it just makes it a lot harder.
So one of the things you talk about, I've heard you talk about a little bit in some interviews, is something that I think a lot about, which is, like, there's a lot of organizations in the world and teams that are good in analytics, but the actual implementation of that analytics, most are bad at. So you might have a great analytics department, a lot of really smart people, but they're, like, kind of, like, stuck in a closet and they don't actually influence. How do you think organizations can get better at the implementation part of analytics, and even just not just teams, like, companies generally? Because I think that this translates also to, like, companies outside of sports.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest mistakes I see now, because, you know, what I'm doing now is basically we have a consulting company where we go into different football clubs and we help them get started, is there's not enough upfront thought about how is this department or this organization going to fit into the broader picture, and how is it going to actually influence decisions? Because at the end of the day, what you really want is better decision making, not necessarily, like, the best analytics department. Analytics obviously is going to help with better decisions because it has, like, a whole host of advantages given or over the way that people typically make decisions. But that's kind of, like, the hard part, and people don't think about it enough. It's kind of like, well, let's just get someone in the door and then we'll figure it out. Where I think it's got to be the other way around, of, like, how are we going to fit this in? Like, what types of decisions do we want to make based off of this information? How are these different streams of information all going to come together? So I think, like, a good example from this, from my time at Microsoft. So I was working at Bing, the Microsoft search engine. And so we had, like, a ton of data, like, basically every query that every user was entering. We knew, like, hundreds of different metrics about, like, you know, what link was returned, what did they click on, how long did they spend on that page, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, like, there was a huge investment into the infrastructure to store all of this data and then allow people within the team to kind of analyze it. And this was at, like, a really, like, early stage before, like, AWS was really a thing, before Azure was a thing. Like, a lot of this technology actually became Azure. But this was, like, not a trivial task, but, like, they did it in a way so that they said, you know, all of our kind of, like, product development decisions are going to be based off of what are our users doing. All of our release criteria of whether or not we think this feature is successful is going to be based off of this data. And so they really had, like, a very strong idea of, you know, what types of decisions are we going to make off of this and how. And, like, certainly there were situations where, like, you know, there would be a feature that didn't necessarily, like, fit into that box. And so you had to adjust. But I think that's much better than kind of saying, like, well, let's build it and then figure it out as we go along, you know. And I think particularly in sporting organizations, the other thing that I've seen is that it really has to come from the top down rather than bottom up. Like, I think, you know, there've been job advertisements out there saying, like, we need a head of analytics to come in and drive cultural change. Like, that shouldn't be the job of the head of analytics. like the cultural change needs to come from the top. It's much easier to get everybody aligned when, you know, it's the people at the top saying, this is how we're going to do business, rather than somebody coming in and constantly have to justify what they're doing. And then, you know, the decision maker above them saying like, okay, this is great, but I'm going to just kind of do what I was doing all along. But thank you for your input.
Okay, let's move into some more soccer nerddom, or sorry, football nerddom. When you think about the work that you did at Arsenal, how much of your edge do you think is in recruitment versus player development?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So player development, I think, is a really like nascent area of using analytics in soccer, but it's also somewhere where we spend a decent amount of time at Arsenal. You know, we collected data down to the U15 level, and we use that in terms of like structuring individual development plans for the players. So, you know, it was kind of helping the practitioners do what they were already doing. So it's hard to say that like we had a huge impact there. I think it was still one of those things where you had good practitioners with good players in the catchment area. I mean, London is just ripe. It's so full of talent. But we were able to kind of like maybe have like a marginal improvement over what they were doing, kind of giving them like a less biased view of a player, maybe some insights into strengths and weaknesses of players that they wouldn't have had. And so, you know, it's not to say that like we helped develop hundreds of millions of dollars worth of talent, but, you know, the amount of talent coming through that Arsenal Academy has skyrocketed since we implemented this plan. And so maybe that's enough to just kind of like tip the odds in your favor. But I still think it's an area that's like drastically I wouldn't say misunderstood, but like, we just don't know enough about like, you know, how to actually develop talent. I think it's what we helped with is making better decisions about what players should focus on, who they should retain, rather than actually like, how do you become a better soccer player? Like that, I think, is still a little bit of like magic and mystery for us. But, you know, recruitment, like maybe not necessarily at Arsenal, but I think like that's the low hanging fruit for most clubs getting started in analytics, is just focus on recruitment, because that is an area that's really well understood. And I think there's still a lot of clubs operating out there without as much information as you. And so you can have like a much better edge. And, you know, I say maybe not for Arsenal, because a lot of the clubs that they're competing for or competing with for players are also using similar techniques. And so then it comes down to who has a more attractive footballing project, who can pay a higher salary, things like that. So there haven't been that many players that have been signed that like we weren't aware of, in terms of like how good they are. It was more of just like, is that the right player for us at the right time, at the right price?
How much of, just real quickly on the player development piece, but would you call that analytics, or is that more like just developing frameworks to understand better like progress and whatnot? Which I mean, the word analytics is tough, because like it means so many different things to so many people, and it carries like a lot of triggering kind of things for people. But would you consider that analytics, or more just like actually having a strong framework to actually better improve player development?
Yeah, I mean, I think it all comes down to like having a strong framework and like actually putting a lot more like scientific rigor behind these things. And it's really hard, because you're talking about a football club that's going to have 25 to 30 players per age group per year. So it's hard to do like rigorous science on such a small number of players. And then, you know, what makes it hard is you can't do too many longitudinal studies, because the game is evolving so much. You know, the physical demands on a player now aren't the same as what that 13-year-old in your academy is going to experience if they want to make it to the Premier League.
Okay, how about this? What are one or two completely outside the box theories that you have that you're trying to prove?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty like conservative person, so I don't know how outside of the box these are, but I guess I have two. One, it's not that outside of the box. I think scouting can be done so much better. Like, I don't want to come on here and say like you don't need scouts. but I will come on here and say, like, the way that scouts use their time is not efficient, and they're not generating, let's say, as good insights into a player as they could. They certainly add value for things that data can't capture, but I don't think that's where they're spending their time, and I don't think they're doing it in a way that's rigorous or repeatable. So that's one that's not that out of the box. The other one is really around the recent, I mean, it's post-COVID changes to the number of substitutes. So in soccer, they went from 3 to 5 substitutes per match. And, you know, we haven't really seen any teams doing anything that crazy with it. Most of it is still, you know, just changing a few more players in the second half. I would love to have a team come and just be really aggressive with it and put on like some really, I don't know, high octane players in the first half, kind of just suffocate the opposition and then change them for a different type of player to help kind of like control the game. Because, you know, with football, like there's this cliche, goals change games. And like, it's true. Like there's such a huge scoreline effect where if you go up a goal or down a goal, the way that you approach the game usually changes. And this is kind of like based on the players, what they've been taught, but then also like managerial styles. And so, you know, I think there's huge opportunity for you to try to exploit that using subs and kind of like how you construct your squad. And, you know, we're just not seeing that happen. So like, we can't prove that with the data because it's not showing up in the data, but I think it would be like a really cool thing to try.
So in terms of scouting, I've had this theory that, like, for example, a golfer that grew up playing in Denmark or Sweden and had a shorter season, like, has more improvement left, or a football player who's had poor coaching has like more room for improvement. And I'm guessing you signing players like young, and so you really care about that trajectory. So how much do you consider that, like, trying to find people that have not had that like have more upside because they haven't had good coaching or haven't played as much?
Yeah, this is something that we try to study a lot. Like, we still don't really know what's coachable and what isn't. Like, it's just fascinating to me how little we know about the sport. You know, where it does come into play quite a lot is like the miles on their legs. So what we see is that players who kind of become professional at 16 or 17, they're going to have like an earlier end to their career more often than not, just because they have so many matches under their legs. So rather than looking at, you know, calendar age, looking at kind of like football age and how advanced they are. But yeah, that's something that we try to study in terms of like what can be coached, how much is left to be coached there. And then the flip side is what coaches are really good at improving those things. And there's just so many factors because, you know, football is very much like a team sport, like not just in terms of players, but even coaching staffs. Like a coach might be good at it, but it might be because he has a really good number two, or he might be working with like a, you know, as kind of like set piece specialist or a different like player development coach. So kind of isolating it and saying that this individual was really good at it is, it's just so hard. There's so many different factors at play, but you know, I think that's one of the remaining edges out there in terms of recruitment, is like trying to figure that out.
In terms of recruitment also, there's obviously the leagues that have tracking data, and then there's leagues that don't have tracking data. Do you think there's good ways to measure what are the ways to sort of measure athleticism in leagues where there's no tracking data, or those, is that a journey that you take on?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And like, this is one of the things that, like, I don't know, just kind of drives me crazy about the sport, is like, what does athleticism even mean? And when you talk to different people, they'll have different definitions. And so I think like getting a little bit more clarity in terms of like, are you talking about athleticism in terms of like ability to jump? Is it strength on the ball, holding off defenders while dribbling? Is it, you know, top end speed? Is it explosiveness over short distance? Is it having an engine where you can kind of get up and down the field a lot? So there's like so many aspects to athleticism that you could want to measure. So even with tracking data, it's a little bit hard because a lot of the kind of like traditional out of the box metrics don't capture a lot of what I just said. They might capture one or two of those, but if you can start to break it down into its components, there's different ways that you can start to, look for, metrics that might be a proxy for some of these things. So if you're looking for a fullback that can get up and down, there's different ways you can look at the event data that's kind of prolific across almost every league now and say, what's the percentage of touches they have in the attacking third versus defensive third? Can I look at those videos where they're getting forward and then watch and see like how quickly do they come back? This is one of the hard things I think in football is that even for scouts, assessing athleticism is really hard and it's like really anchored to the quality of opposition. So even just looking at like those video clips might not give you like a really good idea of their athleticism, but I think breaking it down into those component pieces and then trying to see like what do we know about where they were and where they went. I'm also a really big fan of manual data collection. Like this is something that it's kind of a luxury of working at a big team where you have a lot of people, but there's certain ways that you can kind of like manually collect data around some of these things and there's tools to help you measure. And so, it might not be the most precise measurement of high-end speed, but you could at least start to collect some information around, what was this person doing in this game? How many kind of like sprints did he have versus somebody else?
Okay, and on along those lines a little bit, in basketball, with what's publicly available, it's much easier to measure offensive impact than defense. The same is sort of true in soccer. So what are some ways using data to single out individual defensive impact?
Yeah, this is one of the hardest things because there's so much that goes into evaluating whether or not somebody is a good defender. And there's so many complex interactions on the field where, on initial glance, it might look like this player is out of position. But if you rewind the film back a little bit, well, they're out of position because this other guy made a bad decision, so they're coming over to cover for that bad decision. So, even with tracking data, again, even with your eyes, it's kind of not always clear like how to measure some of these things. So there's a couple of things that we do to kind of look at these things. And so, I don't want to give too much of what we're doing away, but we have models to kind of see like, well, where should the ball have gone in this situation? Where did it go? Who do we think is responsible for kind of steering the ball over to there? And there's flaws with it because it could be that you have Messi on the other side of the ball, other side of the field. So like obviously his teammates are gonna try to shift the ball that way. But we're hoping that over a large enough sample, accounting for quality of opposition on the pitch, you can kind of see like who's influencing where the ball goes based on their positioning rather than let's say tackles or interceptions, things like that. And you can do that type of inference without tracking data, so just off of event data, which is pretty cool.
Okay, final question for me, Rufus, and then maybe if you want to fire away one. It's interesting that you've decided to start a business and sort of like this consulting, because ultimately, when you think about maybe the lessons from Stats DNA and sort of the TAM and the ultimate goal of getting acquired by a club, I've always wondered about there being limitations in the sports consulting and data space. What's your sort of thesis on that, and what's the goal behind what you're doing? And maybe just tell a little bit about, I guess you've told a little bit about what you guys are doing, but maybe just the broader goals of what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, so when I left Arsenal, it was kind of a question of like, what's next, what's interesting, and one of the reasons I decided to leave was I felt like I'd kind of stopped growing on a personal level. I've been there close to 10 years, and it's a great club, so not a lot of people leave. So you're kind of working with the same people with the same ideas in the same way that you always have. So I wanted to just kind of try something new. But the idea of going to like another Premier League club or maybe like a La Liga club and just kind of starting from zero and starting over again wasn't really that appealing because it just felt like we'd be kind of solving the same problems over and over and over again. And so we ended up setting up this consulting business, one, to like kind of learn, you know, like doing recruitment or, you know, player development at a club like Arsenal, like it only gives you one view into football because it's such a unique position to be kind of like literally at the top of the footballing pyramid. And so this way we get to see like, well, how do clubs of different sizes, different economic power operate? Like, what is it like when, you know, for our MLS clients, like they can literally recruit from anywhere in the world. Like, how do you solve that versus at Arsenal, there's, you know, realistically only a small handful of leagues where a player can just kind of go from that league straight into the Arsenal first team. So a lot of it is really around like learning. But, you know, what we try to do is help clubs that are pretty early on in their analytics journey get started. So there's like a very natural timeline for that relationship because we want them to eventually be self-sufficient and have everything internal and they're building kind of like competitive advantage for themselves within their club. And so the reason we've structured it that way is that, you know, we're kind of building this intelligence platform that we think can really help run a club in like a really modern, well-informed way. And so that's kind of like our end goal with this is like, can we build something that, you know, either we raise money to acquire a club or, a progressive ownership group comes in and say, hey, we'd like to use your stuff to help run a club. But I just think there's so much inefficiency in the football industry still in terms of how clubs are run, how decisions are made, and, you know, what we're building can hopefully help address that.
Awesome. Rufus, do you have anything?
I mean, I was going to say, ask kind of how that fits into all these, like the trend now is to buy European soccer teams, football teams, I guess, and try to help them move up with analytics. And if those teams are more like they want to do things their way, or they're open to outside counsel.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. And that would be kind of like an ideal, you know, fit for us in some ways where running one football club is incredibly hard. And then you have these ownership groups that are like, well, let's do that, but multiply it by five. And like, you know, to me, it just seems like incredibly hard, especially if you don't have a really good strategy around making decisions, because there's so many decisions you have to make on a daily basis at a football club. But then going into these like transfer windows is like, yeah, it's just overwhelming. And so I couldn't imagine having to do that for five clubs at once without like a really coherent strategy in terms of like, you know, what are you trying to achieve? What's the best way possible to achieve that? So yeah, totally agree.
All right, Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time. Obviously, we're huge fans of your work and the impact that you're having on soccer and look very forward to hearing about the next step or chapter in your journey. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. This was a lot of fun.
So that was our interview with Sarah Rudd. Rufus, what did you think?
I thought it was interesting. And I think I noted some of the things I thought were really interesting, just that I could relate to. But having to, you know, it's not just building a model or something like that. It's there's the whole communication piece and the strategy piece and all that. So I think to me that it's a different challenge that involves the kind of stuff I do plus more.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see her approach to building influence, which is a very humble approach. It's a very like modest and, you know, self-aware approach, which is something I think that we feel, or that I feel, that analytics people largely miss often because they're trying so hard to prove they're the smartest people in the room. And that just makes you largely unapproachable. So that idea I thought was really interesting. I mean, I think just the idea of how she's this trend, you know, like Kyle Bodie, when we had him on, talked a little bit about it too. It's this idea of like using analytics and frameworks to do player development. And so ultimately this concept of, you know, how do you help people improve, like this notion that, you know, I think that in Moneyball, like, you know, there's really a lack of a focus on improvement, and it's more just on, you know, really like the analytics around scouting. And I think that's somewhat a testament to where Billy probably was in his journey at that point. Because we know Billy's not an analytics guy, right? Billy is a guy that played the game that was very welcoming and understanding of analytics, but he himself is not. So like he may not have had the ideas around how to use analytics to improve player development. But then you get someone like Sarah or Kyle Bodie, I think, who basically want to apply all these frameworks to sort of everything they do and look for inefficiencies there. And certainly player development seems like a big area for you know, incremental gain if you can do it.
I think that's kind of the biggest thing. You know, you can have whatever type of scheme, but if you don't have good enough players, you're not gonna win.
Yeah, agreed.
It's kind of like, Jeff, I hate to say this, but all the harping on fourth down decision making and stuff like that, and when to go for two and when to not go for two. I mean, it's kind of a very small detail relative to the other things that go into whether a team wins or not, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, you've said this, and I'll give you credit for sort of saying this. It's like that's out in the public, and so people talk about it a lot, but it's really not. It's really so small on the margin.
It's observable.
I do think, and right,
and the other stuff is.
And I don't know if I've gone through this whole diatribe about the Super Bowl, but I do think that Kyle Shanahan's like refusal to adapt, not to approach the game in a slightly different way than he does right now, meaning like we know that you have four downs and you can use them, right? And it's not that I care about any individual decision he makes. It's that over the course of a season or a game or now a bunch of different playoff runs, he still refuses to coach as if he has four downs. And instead, now he's a great coach, so I'm not. But I do think, again, like if
but
you go
he could
back
be
to
better,
the,
basically, is what you're saying.
Well, and again, like if you go back to the name of this podcast, right? It's Bet the Process.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if he had a better process in approaching these in-game decisions, he would give his team more chances to win. Is it like how big is the incremental chances? I don't know. Not huge, but at least you wouldn't have to listen to me bitch about it anymore. Anything else on that interview?
No.
I mean, I think the other thing for me is just this notion of this, you know, like, well, one, two things. One, I think people always ask us, how do I get into sports? And how she did it, right? Which was like basically do a research paper and prove that you can do something and don't sit around and say, how do I get into sports? Who do I need to know? Go do it, right? And that's impressive in itself, like this idea that like, and I think it's somewhat similar to the way that you kind of got into sports where, you know, you did a thesis on it and you went and proved it and you explored. And even just some of the things we talked about, if we loop back to like Blair Hull and Petra from Hull Tactical, this idea of like going and reading research papers or doing things and like proving things out and looking for, you know, having a thesis yourself and a hypothesis, there's nothing stopping you from doing that, right? There's nothing stopping you from proving that you can provide value at some level in sports. So I thought that was interesting. And then I do think this idea that she's starting a sports stats consulting business is interesting because I do think there's always a limitation to where that goes because everyone wants to do this, right? Everyone wants to start the next and everyone wants to start the unabated too. They want to start the Bloomberg for sports. It's like, but how do you really use data analytics and sports to build a big business? And sadly, I think that's yet to be understood.
How do you get it to scale?
If any of you guys are wondering, Rufus is leaning back looking pensively, which does not make for good radio, but if we were reading a script, it would say in parentheses, Rufus thinking.
See, I don't even know because Jeff, I hide myself from the view. So I just see you because I don't like looking at myself as distracting.
Yeah. Well, you're a very distracting human being.
I am.
Because you're so damn good looking.
Got to go there again, huh?
All right. That's good enough for now. Let's talk to you guys all next week. Or who knows? Oh, I think we're going to try to have someone for college basketball on. We reached out
to
Ken Tom.
We got to talk March Madness.
We got to talk to March Madness.
And, you know, like I wanted to do Bet the Process Calcutta. We have in our Bet the Process Calcutta chat, I created a poll on would people participate. And literally we have two yeses that have responded. So this is rather sad.
Might be the end. Might be the end of the Bet the Process Calcuttas. So, anyways, we'll talk to you guys all again next week. Thank you. Crunching all the numbers in a simulated system that break down the data analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic. The bottom line is watered down. It seems like they don't get it. Puppeteers are but the engines running off of leaded. None of it's organic. It all sounds synthetic. That's why I fucks with Jeff Ma and his dog Rufus. No locks of the year. They just tell you what their truth is. Maybe make your pockets fatter as the bookies get thinner. Give the information turn and losing betters into winners. Yeah. Sam Hahn, reppin' Rutgers, Jeff Ma, Rufus Peabody, crunching all the numbers, Massey Peabody rankings, we're looking for the edge, analytically driven, crunching all the numbers.